Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Department of Sociology at Boston University titled Foundational Violence, U.S. Settler Colonial Articulation of Racialized and Gendered Citizenship. Our speaker is Evelyn Nakano Glenn, a professor of the Graduate School and founding director of the Center for Race and Gender at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Nakano Glenn's lecture is titled Foundational Violence, U.S. Settler Colonial Articulation of Racialized and Gendered Citizenship. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Saida Grundy, Assistant Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at Boston University.
One of the rare and cherished joys of this profession lies in the opportunity to meet, and in this case to introduce, those scholars whose work has shaped your mind since you first began courting your own sociological imagination. For myself, this began in my earliest days as a first-year student at Spelman College, and being exposed to a canon of radical feminist scholars of color and having this name, Evelyn Nakano Glenn, mount the headings of readings that formed many of my foundational understandings of Black feminism in America. Her scholarship exposed the historical intersectionality of race, gender, suffrage, and citizenship, and ushered me into a life of the mind that I have been pursuing ever since. Professor Glenn's work not only summoned me to this profession, but told me that I had a place here. Because I first learned the history of U.S. immigration and citizenship through her intersectional frames, I never had to unlearn the dominant false narratives that I encountered elsewhere in this field. It turns out that not having to unlearn bad scholarship saves a lot of time in one's career and intellectual pursuits. Reading and teaching good sociology is very efficacious. So I mean this when I say that an entire generation of young scholars, particularly young feminist scholars, race scholars, and those of us who are both, thank you for starting us out ahead of where our understandings would have been had your contribution to the field not been so significant and unignorable. Our speaker, Evelyn Nakano Glenn, is a professor of gender and women's studies and of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley, of which she is an alumna. She serves as the founding director of Berkeley Center for Race and Gender, which is the leading U.S. academic center for the study of intersectionality along lines of gender, race, and class. She completed her doctoral training at Harvard University and took her first academic appointment right here in the Department of Sociology at Boston University. And I'm told that Julian Goh inherited her office, which must be where all the good books, you know, come from this office. It must be good luck in there, right? She is past president of the Society for the Study of Social Problems in the American Sociological Association, where her 2010 presidential address entitled Constructing Citizenship, Exclusion, Subordination, and Resistance was subsequently printed as the lead article in the American Sociological Review. Her work first focuses on dynamics of race, gender, and class and processes of inequality and exclusion. She's the author of numerous articles, reviews, and essays, as well as 6 books, among them Unequal Freedom, How Race and Gender Shaped American Citizenship and Labor, Ise Nise War Bride, 3 Generations of Japanese American Women in Domestic Service, and Forced to Care, Coercion and Caregiving in America. Given the impact and rigor of her work, it is no surprise that she is the recipient of numerous awards, including ASA's Oliver Cromwell Cox Award and Jesse Bernard Awards Society for the Study of Social Problems Lee Founders Award for Life Achievement. I could go on, but I will introduce our speaker at this time, Professor Evelyn Nakano Glenn.
So my talk today brings together 2 threads in my scholarly work. One has been tracing how race and gender have operated as central organizing principles of American citizenship. In doing so, I have become aware that conceiving of citizenship primarily as a formal legal status is simply inadequate. Such a conception tends to focus on the citizen-non-citizen dichotomy and to draw attention to formal exclusion or inclusion of various social groups. However, in looking at the experience of social minorities, I have been struck by the contradictions and fluctuations in social recognition and substantive rights accorded to various groups such as Native Americans, white women, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans. Even when they are legal citizens, their status actually tends to be very precarious. Notorious examples that come readily to mind are blacks in the Jim Crow South being systematically disfranchised and put to forced labor in direct violation of the 13th and 14th Amendments, which were designed, in fact, to recognize black citizenship. There's also the World War II incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, the majority of whom, like my parents, were birthright citizens. A third example is the Depression-era mass deportation, repatriation of 350,000 to 600,000 Mexican Americans to Mexico, again, many of whom were birthright citizens. Thus, I have turned to a more sociological conception of citizenship as being a matter of belonging. In this approach, citizenship is defined as full membership in the community within which one lives. And membership, in turn, entails recognition by other members of the community and focuses attention on everyday practices that confirm or challenge the boundaries of citizenship. In short, it draws attention to the contested nature of citizenship, a contestation that goes on in many areas of life, not just in courts or formal venues, but also in workplaces, parks, stores, public transportation, and many other parts of civil society. The second strand of my research, particularly recently, has been to explore the continuing significance of settler colonialism for U.S. race and gender formation. Of particular interest has been uncovering settler colonial logics and dynamics that have led various social minorities being viewed as outsiders, or what Lorenzo Veracini calls exogenous others. The response to that has been that these groups must be eliminated, contained, or controlled in order to maintain the white heteronormative order. This strand helps to trace how and why U.S. national identity and citizenship were constructed as white and continue to be so constructed despite the presence of substantial numbers of non-white citizens living within its borders. So this is one of my first attempts at weaving these two strands of work into a single presentation. So I will first expand on the sociological conception of citizenship and apply it to probing race and gender dynamics of American citizenship. And then next I will amplify on settler colonial logics that help to account for whiteness as a constituent feature of American citizenship, thereby rendering those deemed to be non-white into exogenous others. So now the first point, which is developing that sociological conception of citizenship, one that highlights substantive rights. Historically, the only group that has consistently enjoyed both full legal and substantive rights has been the ideal citizen, as imagined by the founding fathers, namely the property-owning male head of household. Despite the eventual extension of formal citizenship rights, for example, the franchise, to various others, such as white women, Native Americans, blacks, and other racial and sexual minorities, recognition remains precarious and contingent for these groups. If substantive citizenship requires recognition by others, it means that members of the community necessarily participate in the drawing of boundaries and defining who has standing and therefore is entitled to civil, political, and social rights. For example, during the during the Jim Crow era, which flourished between the 1870s and the 1960s, racial segregation in the South was mandated by state and local laws, sanctioned by federal courts and enforced by local officials. However, segregation could not be maintained on a daily basis without the participation of ordinary people in policing race lines. Segregation of streetcars meant that whites rode in the front and blacks in the rear. However, often there was no fixed physical line. Instead, the lines demarcating the white section were established by how far back whites chose to sit. Segregation of public conveyances was carried out and enforced not only by white drivers, conductors, and police, but also by white passengers. At the same time, however, community members can also act on the basis of schemas of race, gender, and citizenship that differ from those in formal policy or law. For example, when the United States took over the Southwest from Mexico in 1848, it agreed under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that all Mexicans residing in the territory would be recognized as U.S. citizens unless they elected to remain citizens of Mexico. In an era when full citizenship rested on white racial status, Mexicans by implication became white. And indeed, that was the explicit policy of the U.S. government. For this reason, Mexicans were not enumerated separately from whites in the U.S. census until 1930. Anglos in the Southwest, however, did not recognize the official whiteness of Mexicans and often refused to view them as Americans entitled to political and civil rights. As a result, even though segregation of Mexicans was technically illegal, de facto segregation was rampant. Mexican children were assigned to separate schools. Municipal swimming pools barred colored patrons, including Mexicans, except on the day before the pool was cleaned. In Anglo cafes, Mexicans were allowed to eat only at the counter or to use takeout, and in theaters, they were relegated to the balcony. In the other direction, groups have also acted on concepts of citizenship that differ from those of the dominant society. Elsa Barkley Brown found that in Reconstruction-era Richmond and other parts of the South, African Americans operated in two separate political arenas, external and internal. The external realm corresponded to institutions of the larger white-dominated political order. Within this external realm, black women were disfranchised. The internal arena, however, corresponded with organizations and activities of the African American community. Within this internal realm, black women were enfranchised, and black men's vote was considered a collective resource of the African American community. Thus, thousands of African American women attended the Virginia Republican Convention that took place from December 1867 to March 1868. Black women did not intend to be mere observers. They expected to take an active part, and they did so, engaging in heated debates in the galleries, making their concerns known to candidates, and supporting black speakers who looked up at them while making oratorical points. Outside of convention hours, they gathered at mass meetings to discuss and vote on the positions that black male delegates should take. Community votes were taken by voice or rising, and all in attendance, women, children, and men, voted. The actions of African American women participating and voting in internal political meetings were rooted in an alternate conception of democratic representation. These women were engaged in what anthropologist James Holston calls insurgent citizenship. In Holston's words, quote, contemporary citizenship develops as assemblages of entrenched and insurgent forms, unquote. He describes insurgency as a counterpolitics to the dominant historical formulation. At its most effective, insurgency, quote, destabilizes the present and renders it fragile by defamiliarizing the coherence with which it usually presents itself. In this case, African-American women threw into question the individualistic conception of citizenship and what constituted appropriate political behavior. So I want to turn to this framework to address two interrelated questions. How did U.S. citizenship become understood as white in the first place? And why has it so remained, even in the face of formal citizenship being extended to previously excluded non-whites? Relatedly, how did whiteness become a constituent aspect of national identity? That is, how did the nation itself come to be understood as white? The concept of settler colonialism has been most clearly elaborated by scholars of indigenous studies, especially in Australia and Canada, and more recently the U.S. Although it may seem to be best suited to explain the racialization and treatment of indigenous peoples, I agree with the Australian anthropologist Patrick Wolfe when he says that settler colonialism should be seen not as an event, but as an ongoing structure. The logic, tenets, and identities engendered by settler colonialism persist and continue to shape race, gender, class, and sexual formations right into the present. Scholars of settler colonialism argue that it is a distinct form of colonialism that needs to be theorized separately from colonialism more generally. In contrast to classic colonialism, or sometimes people call it, franchise colonialism, whose aim is to take advantage of resources that will benefit the metropole, settler colonialism's object is to acquire land so that colonists can settle permanently and form new communities. The differing goals of classic colonialism and settler colonialism leads to a second major difference, their confrontation with indigenes. In classic colonialism, the object is to exploit not only natural resources, but also human resources. So native inhabitants constitute a cheap labor source to be harnessed to produce goods and extract materials to send back to the metropole. Natives also serve as consumers, expanding the market for goods produced by the metropole and its other colonies. So goods and raw materials like colonists follow a circular path in classic colonialism. In contrast, settler colonialism's object is to acquire land and gain control of resources. To realize these ambitions, the indigenous occupants of the land must be eliminated. This can be accomplished in a variety of ways. Genocide, forced removal from territories desired by white settlers, and confinement to reservations outside the boundaries of white settlement. It can also be accomplished through assimilation so that the indigenous literally disappears. Assimilation can be biological, through intermarriage to dilute indigenous blood. So one of the things that's interesting is that whereas the sort of one drop rule applies to African Americans, with Indians, sort of the dilution of Indian blood tends to disappear the Indian. So the idea is, the other way, of course, is cultural, that is by stripping indigenes of their culture and replacing it with settler culture. So it's biological and cultural. Political historian Walter Hickson documents the almost continuous history of settler colonial ethnic cleansing. Regular outbreaks of warfare occurred throughout the 17th century, second half of the 18th, and the 19th centuries, as settlers pressed up against lands inhabited by Native Americans, first in the East and then the Midwest and finally the West. Some genocidal campaigns were carried out by official military forces, but many were unauthorized actions by settler vigilantes. Such irregular actions tended to be indiscriminately violent, as settler militias burned and leveled crops and shelters and slaughtered women, infants, and elderly. And I think this is a not known aspect of Indigenous history, which is that large numbers of Indian survivors of such raids, particularly women and children, were taken as slaves. They did not work alongside black slaves. Rather, they were traded on the international market in the Caribbean and South America, which helped to defray the cost of warfare and also acquired supplies to build settler plantations. Warfare escalated during and after the Civil War as American settlers pushed to occupy remaining lands in the West, and Native tribes fought to preserve their ways of life. The massacre at Wounded Knee, 1890, that resulted in the death of 300 Sioux warriors was one of the last major battles and mostly ended Indian resistance, armed resistance. Conflicts over territory were also resolved by removal and relocation. During the presidency of Andrew Jackson, and at his urging, the U.S. Congress passed the Indian Removal Act of 1830. This act targeted the five civilized tribes of the Southwest, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminoles. They were so-called civilized tribes because they had gone furthest in adopting the culture and ways of the white settlers, including the ownership of black slaves. Their assimilation to white ways, however, did not save them. Through treaty, these tribes were prevailed upon to cede their traditional lands in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida in exchange for land west of the Mississippi. Tribal members were sent on long forced marches without adequate provisions. En route, thousands of men, women, and children perished from hunger, cold, and disease. Near the end of Indian armed resistance in the West, in the 1880s, federal Indian policy turned decisively toward assimilation, or as it was often dubbed, Americanization. So if you can catch the kind of irony of that. The aim was to phase out Indian treaty rights and other special statuses so as to absorb indigenous peoples into settler societies. The twin prongs of Indian assimilation policy were land allotment and education. Under the Dawes Act of 1887, the federal government divided tribal lands into individual allotments. Heads of household were entitled to 160 acres, single individuals to 60 acres, and those under 18 to 40 acres. Importantly, the large surplus left after allotments, and that was about two-thirds of the land, was made available to white settlers and railroad companies for development. So obviously the net result of allotment policy was to drastically reduce the amount of land owned by Indians collectively and individually. Special education for Indian children was meant to complement allotment by preparing Indians for new productive roles in American society. Starting in the 1880s, reformers' designs for Indian children consisted of two components: child removal and placement in boarding schools. Indian parents were pressured to let their children be enrolled with promises of giving them a better life. Once at school, Indian children were shorn of their long hair and issued settler clothing. They were prohibited from speaking their native languages and from practicing native religions and rituals. Boys were trained in farming and trades, and girls in domestic skills. Ultimately, the aim of Indian schooling was to impose cultural death. Colonel Richard C. Pratt, the founder and head of the Carlisle Indian School, which was the first boarding school, Indian boarding school, proclaimed in a speech given in 1892, quote, "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead. Kill the Indian in him and save the man." The decades of the 1940s and 60s saw still another shift in settler policy toward Native Americans. The intent was to break Native American communal orientation and tribal ties and assimilate them as individuals into settler society. In 1953, the U.S. Congress passed legislation terminating the tribal status of many Indian groups. Many reservations were also terminated, and reservation land sold off primarily to non-Indians. Tribal members were unilaterally made U.S. citizens, subject to taxes and state laws from which they had been exempt. A link policy was to disperse Indians away from the reservation. The Indian Relocation Act of 1956 paid moving expenses and provided vocational training and job placement to Native Americans willing to leave the reservations for 9 designated urban centers, which included Chicago, Denver, Los Angeles, etc. An estimated 750,000 Native Americans were induced to migrate to cities between 1950 and 1980. Indian men were attracted into low-level, dead-end jobs, and Indian women were directed into domestic service. Many relocated Indians found the promised jobs and stipends did not materialize and fell on hard times in the city. Even though some Indians returned to the reservation, relocation policy succeeded in dispersing the Indian population. Whereas in 1940, only 8% of Native Americans resided in cities, by 2012, 70% did. So I think this is, again, something that's not widely recognized, which is that the Native American population today is predominantly urban. In this section, next section, I describe the U.S. settler colonialism as a race gender project. By that I mean settler colonists transplanted certain racialized and gendered conceptions and regimes from the metropole, but also transformed them in the context of their experiences in the New World. What emerged out of the settler colonial project was a racialized and gendered national identity that normalized white manhood as synonymous with American citizenship. Since settlers initially were exogenous, others seeking to claim rights to land and sovereignty over those who already occupied the land, they needed to develop conceptions of indigenous peoples as lesser beings. In doing so, they harnessed race and gender to construct a hierarchy of humankind. Conceiving of indigenous people as less than fully human justified dispossessing them and rendered them expendable. Land occupied or used seasonally by indigenes was conceived of as terra nullius, or land belonging to no one, or empty land, and therefore available for taking by white settlers. Simultaneously, settlers conceived of themselves as more advanced and evolved, bringers of progress and enlightenment to the wilderness. So I think that's another trope of the wilderness and, you know, Indians being part of the wilderness. Masculine whiteness thus became central to settler identity, a status closely tied to ownership of property and political sovereignty. According to Arvin et al., the presumption was that, quote, heteropatriarchal nuclear domestic arrangements in which the white father is both protector and leader should serve as the model for social arrangements of the state and its institutions, unquote. As we know, American settlers initially identified with the imperial power and submitted to its rule. However, over time, their interactions with indigenes and experiences in the colony set them apart from the population in the metropole. American settlers attached their identity to the land itself, to the mythological common experience of settlement, and often to the shared goal of self-government. So the frontiersmen and women became symbols of what it meant to be American. This new identity helped bridge differences of class, ethnicity, and nationality that might otherwise have divided whites. Thus, there was greater equality among the settlers than there was in the metropole. European immigrants to the United States who moved west to take advantage of cheap land were quickly granted American citizenship and considered equals among their peers in matters of local government. For example, I found that the first California legislature in the 1850s was made up of men elected to office within a few weeks after they arrived in the state. Another element common to settler colonialism is the, quote, denial and disavowal of the history of violent dispossession of the indigenes. To quote Lorenzo Veracini again, quote, the settler hides behind his labor and hardship. The settler does not dispossess anyone. He wrestles with the land to sustain his family. The settler enters a new empty land to start a new life. Indigenous people naturally and inevitably vanish. It is not settlers that displace them. In short, settler colonialism obscures the condition of its own production. The encounter with the indigene can be viewed as the founding moment for the formation of U.S. whiteness. The savage and eliminatable indigene is racialized as other, in contrast to the civilized sovereign settler who becomes white. And whiteness becomes synonymous with the nation. Aileen Moreton Robinson explains, quote, the USA as a white nation state cannot exist without land and clearly defined borders. It is the legally defined and asserted territorial sovereignty that provides the context for national identification of whiteness. In this way, Native American dispossession indelibly marks configurations of white national identity. Unquote. Thus, whites come to view whiteness as normal and position themselves as full citizens, for citizens, and push non-whites to the margins or even outside the boundaries of citizenship. So as I've stated, in the earlier exposition on the characteristics of settler colonialism, U.S. settler colonialism has been driven by the impulse to gain sovereignty over land, bodies, and labor by turning them into private property that can be bought, exploited, and sold. In this next section, I analyze examples of how this impulse and the institutionalization of property regimes affected not only Native Americans, but also other racialized groups in the past and present. Arvin et al. Explained, quote, within settler colonialism, it is exploitation of land that yields supreme value. Extracting value from the land also often requires systems of slavery and other forms of labor exploitation. These simultaneous processes of taking over the land by killing and erasing the people with previous relationships to the land and importing forced labor to work the land as chattel slaves to yield high profit margins for the landowner produce the wealth upon which the U.S. nation world power is founded. What emerged out of this was a triadic system that brought together the industry of the white settler, the land of dispossessed Native Americans, and the forced labor of enslaved Africans to produce European and white American wealth. Returning to Patrick Wolfe, he notes, quote, ubiquitously, colonizers have encoded and orchestrated this complexity by reference to some version, however inchoate, of the doctrine of race. In the soundbite vocabulary of race, the three points of the Atlantic Triangle, Africa, America, and Europe, became chromatized as black, red, and white, respectively. I'm going to now just briefly refer to settler colonial mobilization of race and gender to manage exogenous others beyond indigenes and enslaved blacks. In contrast to virtuous or potentially virtuous exogenous others, that is, European immigrants, who may be selected for gradual inclusion, undesirable exogenous others, typically racialized immigrants, were considered morally degraded, sometimes irredeemably so. Settler colonialism's response to undesirable exogenous others has often been and still does swing between the poles of elimination and coercive exploitation. Among the groups that can be considered under this rubric are Mexicans and Chinese. These are single nationality groups that are often subsumed under broader designation, that is, you know, Latina or Asian American. For purposes of this analysis, I hone in on the specific groups, Mexicans and Chinese, rather than the broader heterogeneous groupings, because of their long history in the U.S. and their prominent representation in popular culture and in political legal discourse. While the category of exogenous others seems to fit the Chinese, who were viewed and treated as inalterably alien, it may seem incongruent to characterize Mexicans in that way, since Mexicans already lived in the Southwest when the Anglos arrived. Nonetheless, as May Nye, the historian, points out, that when Anglos confronted Mexicans, they perceived Mexicans as foreigners, even though they arrived after the Mexicans. And in the tradition of genocidal violence against Native Americans, both Mexicans and Chinese were targeted for ethnic cleansing. Starting in 1850 with the driving out of Chinese miners in the gold fields and the seizing of their assets, white American settlers carried out more than 200 roundups and expulsions of Chinese over the next half century. The ethnic cleansing drives peaked in the 1880s with Chinatowns in Los Angeles, San Jose, Seattle, and Tacoma being destroyed by white mobs. David Courtwright wrote, quote, "As with Indians to whom whites often compared the Chinese," excuse me, the way such killings were carried out revealed a deep, almost feral hatred. Chinese men were scalped, mutilated, burned, branded, decapitated, dismembered, and hanged from gutter spouts. As for white settler violence against Mexicans, historians William Kerrigan and Clive Webb extrapolated from data from newspaper stories, photographs, letters, journals, and diplomatic records, and argued that, from the California Gold Rush to the last recorded instance of a Mexican lynched in public in 1928, vigilantes hanged, burned, and shot thousands of persons of Mexican descent in the United States. The scale of mob violence against Mexicans is staggering, far exceeding the violence exacted on any other immigrant group, and comparable, at least on a per capita basis, to the mob violence suffered by African Americans, unquote. Ultimately, the main measure devised to eliminate Chinese was legal exclusion. This was accomplished by the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The first ever restriction on entry based on national origin. In contrast, Mexican entry continued freely and without regulation until the 1930s, when the Great Depression heightened anti-Mexican sentiment. The U.S. government attempted to limit entry from Mexico by establishing border patrols and limiting the number of visas. These measures reduced but did not curtail Mexican immigration, which in fact rose again during and after World War II due to the demand for labor in agriculture in the U.S. Immigration from China and other Asian countries rose dramatically, however, after the 1965 Immigration Act, which lifted country quotas and prioritized family reunification. So newcomers from China and Mexico have continued to serve as a source of super exploitable labor during this period. There's also evidence that the increase in Asian immigration was a kind of unintended consequence of the way the immigration laws were written. Okay, so in summary, I believe that a settler colonial structural analysis reveals the underlying systems of beliefs, practices, and institutionalized systems that undergird and link the racialization and management of Native Americans, blacks, Mexicans, Chinese and other non-white groups. It also helps to account for the persistence of a white national identity and the equating of citizenship with whiteness up to the present. As the numerical dominance of Euro-Americans wanes and the nation is projected to become a minority-majority country by the mid-2040s, I guess most of you have heard of this, right? There's a mounting sense of anger and dismay among many whites that they're, quote, losing their country. Much of the anxiety has focused on non-white immigrants, particularly undocumented Latino immigrants, as threats to the American, that is, settler way of life. The perception of a community under siege echoes the obsession with security that is characteristic of settler colonial societies. And just as the threat of Native Americans was met with armed violence, some elements of settler society, especially white supremacists, have turned to vigilante tactics. Prominent examples include the Minuteman Project and the American Border Patrol, who identify their efforts with those of their colonial and frontier forebearers. At its peak in 2010, the Minutemen had 310 affiliate groups that patrol the Arizona and Texas borders to deter border crossings from Mexico. Another notorious example is the armed volunteer posse appointed by Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, I think, who's been in, as many of you have probably seen in the news. He's the sheriff of Mariposa County, which includes Phoenix, and it's the largest county in the entire United States. Since 2005, the posse, as well as official deputies, have been mobilized to assist in apprehending illegal immigrants through racially targeted traffic stops and workplace raids in the Phoenix area. In one infamous incident in 2008, deputies and volunteer posse members occupied the small town of Guadalupe for 2 days. Arpaio's forces patrolled the streets on horseback, patrol cars, unmarked SUVs, sedans, and motorcycles, while a helicopter flew above. They stopped and followed community members walking or driving in town, demanding identification and terrorizing residents. So one final point. I have argued for the continuity of white settler logics and assumptions. Once the demographic tipping point is reached, will the U.S. national identity and citizenship cease to be rooted in whiteness? So I don't think I'm going to be around in 2045, unfortunately, although I think a lot of you may be. But I will engage in speculation. Some scholars, notably Eduardo Bonilla Silva, predict that white dominance will be maintained, buttressed at least conceptually by whitening some individuals and groups, as happened to some European immigrant groups who were not considered white when they first arrived, for example, Italians and Jews. Bonilla Silva argues that a tripartite racial system is emerging in which there will be whites, honorary whites, and collective blacks. Among those being enrolled in the honorary white category are some Asian groups, such as Japanese and Chinese, and light-skinned Latino individuals. Other groups, such as Cambodian and Hmong, are being relegated to the collective black category. So, anyway, I will welcome your comments and questions. My last slide is to remind us one last time of our settler colonial legacy in rather concrete form. This the huge Mount Rushmore monument is built on a mountain that is formerly U.S. that the U.S. government took from the Sioux tribe. The Black Hills were considered have been considered sacred ground by the Sioux, you know, for centuries. The monument celebrates the European, this is from the Sioux perspective, the monument celebrates the European settlers who killed so many Native Americans and appropriated their land. So thank you very much.
interesting and depressing talk.
I'm sorry.
But maybe to insert a little bit of optimism, I'm wondering if you there are things that you didn't discuss, and I wonder if you could comment on them. I mean, there have been movements,
yes,
by indigenous groups or whatever to assert claims, including on the issue of Indianness. So if you know, some Indian groups now, like the Mashpee around here, have suddenly reclaimed their Indianness. And so, I mean, I'm thinking there in the 60s, you certainly had a lot of, you know, indigenous groups.
The occupation of Alcatraz, yeah.
Various things happening. And then you've also had things like A Day Without Immigrants. I mean, it didn't actually go far at that particular point. But there, it seems to me there is, you know, resistance from below, and that really has been missing from your analysis.
Yes, okay. I take that feedback seriously. I think the thing that the implication of a settler colonial perspective is interesting, because it the implication of it is that in order to deal with these kind of settler colonial structures, et cetera, it will require decolonization rather than inclusion, which I think is the typical way in which citizenship or the story of citizenship is told, that, you know, that somehow citizenship has, that the historical story of citizenship is the gradual inclusion of groups within its orbit, right? That, you know, like, well, you know, women were granted the vote in this year, and et cetera. Property restrictions were taken out, the Civil Rights Voting Act, et cetera, although we also go backwards. But I think the important point, at least from the point of view of a lot of the activities of indigenous groups, including Native Hawaiians, is to make the more radical point about decolonization. You know, and some people say, well, the end of settler colonialism is when the settlers leave, which happened in Algeria. And the more radical elements of the Native Hawaiian movement, for example, say that they want to, that basically what has to happen is for sort of Native Americans to become sovereign and sort of, you know, sort of make decisions to decolonize Hawaii, you know, rather than sort of create a multicultural, I don't know what you want to call it, inclusion type thing. So, yes, I didn't talk about the kind of resistance movements, but I guess I feel like I sort of gestured toward that in talking about the undocumented student movement, which definitely has challenged, I mean, it's not just about inclusion, but also, for example, dignity. That is the way the politicians who originally wanted to pass the DREAM Act framed the issue was that, oh, these are ideal American citizens. These are kids who stayed in school, worked hard, got good grades, and they get into college, right? And so these are the, you know, like, so these people are really deserving. And the undocumented student movement itself rejected that formulation and sort of said their cause was common with day laborers and other groups, and that they also asserted what I call that it is a UN human rights thing, but that education is a human rights, and is a human right. And you know, what's interesting there is the U.S. actually doesn't have a right to education as part of its, I don't know what you want to call it, human rights. And the Supreme Court has actually refused to do that, even in the case where they decided that undocumented students children could not be excluded from public schools. They did a much more limited analysis of that by saying, well, we have to look at whether it will do our nation good to have a whole class of
people within its borders that basically have no education. Thurgood Marshall, you know, for years wanted the court to rule that it was actually a constitutional right to have an education. So I guess, again, what I'm saying is that a lot of these movements are really trying to expand the notion of citizenship to do more radical decolonization, et cetera. So, yeah, anyway, I'm not sure I answered any of your questions, but, you know, I think it's a valid point that we have to look at not only kind of what the settler position is, but also what those who are challenging that have been doing. But there is a sort of pessimism in the sense that I think the scholars see that decolonization as extremely difficult. You know, you can have the inclusion, but as I said, the problem is there's a way in which that inclusion is always somewhat precarious and contingent. And so, you know, perhaps there is an element of pessimism in my approach. But I'm a jolly pessimist, so I'm chuckling about it. I don't really mean to chuckle, but, you know.
Thank you very much to Professor Evelyn Nakano-Glenn. It's been a very interesting talk.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Evelyn Nakano-Glenn, a professor of the Graduate School and founding director of the Center for Race and Gender at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Nakano-Glenn's lecture was titled Foundational Violence, U.S. Settler Colonial Articulation of Racialized and Gendered Citizenship, and was presented by the Boston University Department of Sociology. Tonight's moderator was Saida Grundy, Assistant Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Edward T. Mazulis and Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.